This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
When we were organising today, it looked at one point as if Philip Jones might be in Europe. And we were a bit kind of anxious at the idea of having two video recordings back to back. We thought that might be pushing things a bit far, and we were incredibly relieved and delighted when it turned out that Philip would be able to be here rather than on a different continent. He really needs no introduction. I think that his book, Ochre and Rust, is one of the great pieces of Australian cultural history, and we're very lucky to have him here today. Philip Jones.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be talking about a suite of material which Andrew really put on the record in his groundbreaking book. And it was a collection that we'd had at the museum, been hidden from view really for many years. We first published it in Dreamings in 1988, but we could only put a very few images into that publication. Andrew put a few more on the record, larger images actually, and more accessible, and considered them in this broader context in which we're discussing the works today. And I have to say that really, one of the key contributions of that book for my research was the range of material which was suddenly spread out, and the depth and the fact that you could scrutinise particular images. There is still so much to learn about these images, and the dawn of art, every now and again I've dipped back into it, and particularly in the last few weeks, I think it's probably left me more confused than enlightened, but maybe some of that confusion and enlightenment can flow across the podium. And if I can get... Oh, yeah, okay. So that's a key image. It's not a very good image. It's the only one that the Museum of Victoria could give me with short notice. But this gives you an idea of probably the seven of these panels. We now know that there were seven. When Andrew did the book, we didn't really know how many there were. And until a week ago, I thought there were just six panels, but I believe there were seven, and actually a total of 47 sheets of drawings. On the count that I've made of the 24 sheets that we know of today, some 274 individual images, of which more than 250 are animals. Very small number of human figures in that number, and only five or six items of material culture, including two or three canoes and three or four tomahawks, and about 10 pieces of vegetation. So we go back to the frame that you see there, which was the original frame that these works were displayed in just a few years, maybe even months, after they were drawn in 1888 at the Melbourne Centennial Exhibition. The organiser of that exhibition for the Northern Territory, which was, I should remind you, the Northern Territory of South Australia, was J.G. Knight. And this is partly why the collection is best represented in South Australia, because after the exhibition, he saw his role as distributing the material, and he distributed four of the seven panels, as far as we know, into South Australia. to the School of Mines and the Technological Museum. And this is an interesting point. Andrew made the point in the book that a lot of this material, these drawings, made their way into libraries or institutions of one sort or another, never really into art galleries. The secondary effect was their absorption into galleries in the 20th century. So I think looking at these images now, 20 years later, and this was an image that Andrew didn't know about when the book was done, it turned up in the Museum of Victoria, and unfortunately has been removed from the frame. That's another story. But it raises many questions. Who were these artists? And what does the knowledge about them tell us about the dawn of a particular form of art, I would say Aboriginal art under European eyes? I think that's the genre that maybe we're seeing. At what point does Aboriginal art cease being wholly reflective of a society which draws its references from its own traditions and conventions and begins reflecting aspects of a new relationship? What effect does access to new materials, paper and crayons or pencil, have on traditional art and its traditional parameters? What effect does this new capacity to trace fine lines, to produce delicate shading, to add new colours, what effects does that have? And to what extent does the suite of artworks that we'll see here reflect the original intent or preferences of the artist? Did J.G. Knight already know that these drawings would be placed behind a trophy exhibit of weapons in the Centennial Exhibition, and that natural history would be the most appealing component for the exhibition? Was that his direction, or was this the artist's own initiative? So we have documentation of the first moment when crayons and brown paper were distributed to men of the Pintabi, Ngarrindjeri, Pitjantjatjara, Warlpiri, Aliwarra and other groups by Norman Tyndale and Robert Pullin during the 1930s. By our own late 20th century and early 21st century conventions of art scholarship, these men, not Tyndale and Pullin, but the Aboriginal men, because they were men to whom these crayons and brown paper were distributed, these men became artists during that first session with the materials. In the morning of that day, they weren't artists. By the evening, they were. They sat alone working on these drawings, but in a group, almost within touching distance of each other. Just as we see in Charles Mountford's distribution of Bach paintings or his documentation of Bach paintings during the 48 Arnhem Land expedition, each absorbed in their own subjects but connected. Was it always like that? Was it like that with the dawn of art? These drawings contain intriguing indications that the artists were, to some extent at least, looking over each other's shoulders, arriving at essentially similar sets of subjects. Or were they being steered in that direction by J.G. Knight? And were these, in fact, all prison drawings by prisoners, as the documentation and the reportage of the exhibition ran? According to Knight, they were all prison drawings by prisoners incarcerated in what had only really just been built, the Fanny Bay jail, which is still standing, taking over from previously very cramped quarters in the Palmerston jail. We know that at least one of the artists, or we think we know, or I think we do, was never imprisoned. His name was Davy. But also Paddy, I think, was never imprisoned, or if he was, it was for a night, for stealing grog, or perhaps 2 days. Billyamook was in prison. He was in and out of Fanny Bay quite often, but he was also the groundsman, and he spent time in the vicinity. Wandi Wandi was definitely in prison. He was in prison for murder twice. The second time he was hanged in 1891. And Jemmy Miller, who I have to admit to being my favourite, where is he? Top right. Showing evidence of yours, the disease yours. He was in prison for murder. Murder of a white man for stealing one of the women. So I thought I'd put that up just so that you can familiarise yourself with these people. And these are all images taken more or less at the same time as the drawings. And they're all taken by Inspector Paul Folch, which is another very interesting character on the northern frontier. So, to the drawings. And what I want to do is just sort of skim through them, really, if I can find my place. And I can, having already expressed my preference, I can go straight to the person that I think is the least impressive as an artist, and that is Billyamook. Oh, I've got the wrong page. Page 401. Yeah. Compared to the others, I mean, if we only had his work to go by, I think we'd be absolutely besotted with it and fall in love with it. I find it stilted, clumsy. I think he's unfamiliar with the implements that he's got. But nevertheless, there's this vividness about it. It's dynamic. And he is putting things before us that we never thought we would see in that way. He's also using blue in an interesting way, blue which appears in the rock art of the region. It appears Reckitt's blue on the artefacts of the region at this time, in a form like ochre, powder in Reckitt's blue. You could bang it and knock it and crush it and it would turn into ochre in terms of its consistency. Very, very attractive colour, which had not been encountered ever before. So suddenly there's a blue pencil available. It gets used in all of these pictures. But again, every picture raises an issue. What's happening there with the... We know that the captions are being put there, probably by J.G. Knight, in Larrakia and in English, and they're all regular. They're all facing down. But, of course, the animals are not amenable to that, and, you know, some of them are completely upside down. So what that means is that the artist is turning the paper around as he's drawing. And that raises all sorts of questions about where these paintings were, where these pictures were made, and you know, what was the actual mode of production. Why are they all spaced over to the right? Was there an intention to fill the whole sheet or not? We see the old syndrome of the crocodile with a bent tail crammed up against the edge, and so on. All of these elements. Billyamook is extraordinary as well for creating these figures which are just not precedented. We don't see them elsewhere. This four-headed god, as it's described. Now, not much analysis, almost no analysis has been done of the Larrakia terms, so that's still ahead of us to try to analyse what... Is that the name of a figure? Is it the name of a Larrakia ancestor which has slipped off the edge and we will never know what it is? Or is it? Does it bear any relationship with another term? The figure at the bottom looks initially as weird as the figure at the top, but it's actually an upside-down tree. The trunk of the tree is facing down and the roots are above it. Here we are. This is just the... There were just two Billy Muck pictures in the Dawn of Art series that we have in the museum, and this is the third one, which was in the Museum of Victoria, sort of inferior image there. Again, you see the crocodile that's... I mean, you have to think that the artist has started at the top and has misjudged where he'd end up, but we don't really know that. This very large centipede at the top, that appears. It's a reminder that these are people working on the fringe of the coast. They're working, they're mangrove people, basically, the Larrakia, I suppose. Now, one of the most extraordinary things that you see through this collection are winged birds, or birds with wings in flight or outstretched. Are they dead birds lying down with their wings askew, or are they? Is this actually an attempt to put a bird in motion? Second image in the Museum of Victoria series, and again... The blue and Billy Mook's, I think that's also called God, that one. Yeah. So, again, some of the work that we were looking at earlier from southeastern Australia with headdresses, I don't know whether it was which artist it was, but you can see again this convention of putting a kind of a headdress with multiple elements to it. We assume that's what it is. Whoops, how did that happen? Oh, I know, yes. It's just to refer back to the next artist, the Larrakia artist Davey, who's on the centre. He's in the centre. He really contributed most of the drawings to the series as we know it at the moment, and a completely different artist, fluid, elegant, attention to symmetry, detail and colour, spacing on the page, all very regular, in really good control of the pencil. Again, what's happening with that human figure, the body designs which are curving up over the shoulder, is that an attempt to indicate what they look like on the back? In other words, like a sort of early Kellogg's cornflakes cutout figure, could you fold those down over the back and create the figure? Are you meant to imagine that, or is that actually something coming off the body? These are just idle questions. And you can see, once again, the delineation of the wings coming down, the cockatoo as it is, with the little blue eyes and the blue beak. And the figures, when you look at them closely, they are delineated in red, and then the pencil is filled in. Not all of them are in red, but they're generally, you can get an impression when you go closely into them that this is what's happening. And then you see the bird, once again, it's irresistible conclusion that it's in flight. But is it? Davey again, this time with the blue pencil that he has, and various figures. Again, this attention to the delineation of the outside. A couple of leeches there, and a centipede. Once again, a reminder of the coastal proximity. And then another sheet. So some sheets, people are just working with one pencil, three pencils, or two pencils. Seemingly no more than that. And one of the rare examples of one with elements of material culture. And again, you wonder how far that artist might have gone in European terms once you see that picture, that beautifully drawn picture of the canoe and the figures. Also, his exploring a theme on a single sheet of paper, the trees, the palm trees and their fruit, the elongated extension of that fruit in the top one there, and then also maybe the discovery that you can begin shading. You can begin using that pencil to create a sort of variation in effect. And now to my favourite, Jemmy. He really knew what to do with shading, I think. And also you see this, you saw it in some of the southeastern works, this this sort of banding effect across the bodies of animals. See it here in that, in what you might say from a distance is a kangaroo, but if you look at the teeth, and then maybe have a closer look at the feet and the inscription, it's a dingo. The idea of repetition, the banded effect again, and there's the shading, those five brogas or native companions. Quite extraordinary, I think. Ducks, the old bent-tailed crocodile, and that one with almost what I think is happening on the top right is a top view and a lower view of a crocodile. He's actually turned the crocodile over. Scooting ahead, and that's the Museum Victoria image from that series. And finally, no, it's Paddy. Okay. Right. Very unresolved fish. And he never really gets better at those. But again, you see that banding. So you begin to develop an idea of an aesthetic, which is maybe a localised one. It could be spread out across the country and it's disappeared from view. And it's only Andrew's book and the work we're doing now that is bringing this back to the surface, because we've all been overwhelmed by dots and concentric circles, haven't we? But this is an aesthetic which was operating. And it is illustrative, as previous speaker said, that it is, it's not necessarily telling a story, and we shouldn't look for that. And these are not necessarily totemic animals, I'm quite sure. They're just observations, and people are freeing themselves up with these pencils in a way that they couldn't before without a flat surface and this sort of paper to work on. And finally, Wandi Wandi, just three images on a single sheet, three beautiful kangaroos, the lines that extend all the way down the body, just a single line through the body. But again, outlined in red, the forms delineated. J.G. Knight, the person who put it all together, quite eccentric and a very interesting fellow. I'll just finish by quoting something that was put into his obituary. Someone remembered him standing by the work and selecting the worst effort of the whole. This is in the Centennial Exhibition. J.G. Knight parodied the lines of Thomas Gray's Elegy on a Country Churchyard. The verse from the original poem reads, "Let not ambition mock their useful toil, their homely joys and destiny obscure, nor grandeur hear with a disdainful smile the short and simple annals of the poor." And Knight wrote, or said, apparently uttered, ad-libbed, "Let not the critic mock their art grotesque, their pigments few and drawing incorrect. I tell you that this work is picturesque, and for it praise unstinted I expect. So that was his poem, recast on the dawn of art, an indication that he understood the reservations people might have about the work, but he did a very brave thing. He stuck this stuff right up before the Australian public. 40,000 people saw it. There were 7 reviews. 5 of them were effusive in praise for these works, and only slightly facetious, I found. He stood by the works and believed that they were significant, and luckily we have traced at least half of them and maybe have a chance of finding the rest. Thanks.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.